Okay, our first double Legends and Lessons. And the reason that we're doubling up is twofold, which is also double. One is because, bless you.
Thank you.
One is because both of the Yahrzeits happened during the month of Tishrei, which is this month. And second is because they were actually very close. They might not have started off very close in terms of their friendship, but they ended up very close in terms of their families. The two people we'll be talking about are Rabbi Akiva Eiger and Rabbi Moshe Sofer, or Schreiber. And you'll notice pretty quickly that the Chassam Sofer and Rabbi Akiva Eiger actually are only 1 year apart. They're actually 11 months apart. Both lived in the general Austro-Hungarian Empire, Prussia area. Kind of difficult to really pin down because at that time it was all changing, you know, every few years based on different wars that were going on. But they led very similar lifestyles and, I guess, lives. And we'll see a little bit as to what I mean. But let's start with Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Rabbi Akiva Eiger was born in Hungary. Now in a place that's now in Austria, called Eisenstadt. And he was born to two prominent rabbinic families, and he learned from his father, who was also a Rav. And the truth is that his father's name wasn't Eiger. This is one of those interesting things that oftentimes in the 18th century, where there weren't as many people in the world, so the last name wasn't as important to really pin down. And his father's last name was Gins, or Guns, and his mother's last name was Eiger. It ends up being, either because of some medical filing or something, that his last name is officially Eiger in the end of the day. But the truth is that one of his main teachers was also his uncle from his mother. So that could also be another reason why he took on the name Eiger. Welcome back to David. The legend has it that when Rabbi Akiva Eiger was 6 years old, he was not yet Rabbi Akiva Eiger, but he had learned all of Mishnayos at 6 years old. I don't know how that's possible based on what the Mishnah tells us to start learning Mishnayos around that age. So I guess he finished it the second he could start it. But there are many legends about many different rabbis when they were young accomplishing things that don't seem attainable. But this is one of those times Rabbi Akiva Eiger learned all of Mishnayos by the time he was 6 years old. Now at this point, and we're not going to switch back and forth the whole time because that would get very confusing, the Chassam Sofer was born 11 months after Rabbi Akiva Eiger. His father, Reb Shmuel, was also somewhat, you know, in Klei Kodesh. He was a Sofer, which is why their last name was Sofer, or Schreiber, because in Yiddish that means to write, to scribe, and to be a scribe. And his mother, Rezel, was known for her tzidkus, and she was known as Rezel HaTzadekas. I don't know who called her that, but that's what they apparently called her, in Frankfurt. So he's in Germany. And that actually has a lot to do with how his life develops in terms of his perspective on the Enlightenment and things like that, which we'll get to later. So there's an interesting story about the Chassam Sofer's birth, that his mother, Rezel, felt the baby coming, and it was Friday afternoon, and she had asked the community Rav, who usually would bring Shabbos in early. Let's say it's like we do here during the summer, we take it in at a plug. So she asked the Rav, please don't take in Shabbos early so I can have my child first. That's the story that it goes. They named him Moshe, and then they took in Shabbos. That's the story. And the Rav of the town said that because of this, this boy will be a gadol b'Yisrael. Already at 7 years old, he was known as a Talmud Chacham, although it's unclear what credentials he had to be called that at 7 years old. We know Rabbi Akiva Eiger finished Mishnayos, Shas Mishnayos. I'm not sure what the Chassam Sofer did. But Rabbi Akiva Eiger went off to yeshiva in a place called Breslov, not the Breslov that you think, different Breslov, with his uncle, Rabbi Wolf Eiger, who we spoke about. And after he was already starting to give his own classes while he was there in yeshiva. The Chassam Sofer similarly went to his study by another gadol named Rav Nassan Adler, who used to stay by him in Frankfurt, and the Chassam Sofer would stay with his family. Apparently, Rav Nassan Adler also was known to do the chores around the house, whatever. Either way, the Sefer Hafla, people know the Sefer Hafla of Pinchas Horowitz, actually happens to be one of the students of the Maggid of Mezrich, but was more Talmudically inclined than the other the Maggid's other students. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he was the brother of Pinchas Levi Horowitz was the brother of another. I shouldn't have even mentioned if I'm not going to remember his name. He was a brother of. I forgot his name. He had a brother, and the Maggid used to say that they were the two candles that kept Hasidus light. But Rav Pinchas Levi Horowitz was much less Hasidic. I think it was Rav Shmuelke of Nikolsburg. Rav Shmuelke of Nikolsburg's last name was Horowitz, if anyone wants to look it up. I'm pretty sure that's who it was. Rav Shmuelke of Nikolsburg has a much more Hasidic legend, connotation to him, whereas Rav Pinchas Levi Horowitz, the Sefer HaFla, was more of a Talmudist. But either way, they got to know each other, and they learned from each other. Some people say the Chassam Sofer was his Rebbe. Some people say that he was the Chassam Sofer's Rebbe. But either way, he ultimately goes to yeshiva in Mainz, away from Frankfurt, still in Germany, where he was supported by the community. So both Rebbe Kiva Eger and Chassam Sofer are in their respective communities in yeshivas in their teenage years. Both of them, either Rebbe Kiva Eger was teaching already in his teenage years, and the Chassam Sofer was being supported in his teenage years by the community in Mainz. He was then called back to Frankfurt because Rav Nassan Adler wanted to learn with him again. So people are fighting over the Chassam Sofer, people are fighting over Rebbe Kiva Eger. Ultimately, he marries Rebbe Kiva Eger at the age of 18, marries the daughter of a prominent rabbi in a place called Lisa. Anyone ever heard of Lisa? I think I mentioned it recently in a shir. It was the home of the Nesivos HaMishpat. Are you familiar? Rav Yaakov of Lisa. We quoted his ethical will in the shir about whether or not there's a mitzvah to be happy. What he writes to his sons. So Rav Yaakov of Lisa writes a parish called the Sivas HaMishpat, and a very, very deep analysis of Choshen Mishpat. Some of the most complicated stuff that you can learn. He's also known by his Haggadah, which was, legend has it, the favorite Haggadah of the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik, called the Ma'aseh Nisim. Haggadah Ma'aseh Nisim, which I was able to buy for $10 one time, and I just, now I take pride in the fact that I have it. But it's also very Talmudic, and it's not your typical parish. But either way, that's Rabbi Yaakov of Lisa. In the same town, Rabbi Kiva Eger establishes himself there because he marries the rabbi's daughter, and he learns there, but he didn't want to get any money from his learning. So his father-in-law helped him out. So his father-in-law supported him at least at the beginning. It's a place of 5,000 Jews, which sounds like a lot, but then you realize that that's 15% of the entire city. You realize it's only a city of 80,000 people, and it's really not—it's not that big of a city in general. So that's where he is, and so he gets married at 18. He moves there, but by 10 years later, there were a few fires that broke out in Lisa, and unfortunately, it took his father-in-law's home, which also took much of his wealth. So his father-in-law could no longer support him. So at the age of 29, Rabbi Kiva Eger was forced into the Rabbanus. He never wanted to make money for his Rabbanus, as the tradition has it. The Gemara tells us not to make money off Rabbanus, but what can we do? Anas Rachmana Patre, hopefully, on that regard. But either way, so against his wishes, he ends up becoming a Rav in a small city in Prussia called Markisch Friedland. He originally tried to go to another city and ask that city to support him, but it didn't work out. As you can imagine, to introduce a kollel into a city is not an easy thing when they don't have one already, especially when they're a small little place. He wanted to not be a rabbi. He wanted to just be a gabbai. He wanted to be a shamish. He wanted to be the mikveh attendant. But lo and behold, they schlepped him into the rabbanus, and that's why we have a Rabbi Kiva Eger that we can learn from. So he lives there in Friedland for a while, about 7 years, but then his wife passes away. He has three children there. No, he had three children before he got there. He moves there at the age of 29 with three kids, Avram, Shendel, and Shlomo. And while he's in Friedland, he has another daughter named Searle, Sarah, and another daughter, apparently Tzipora, who had unfortunately died in childhood. But in Friedland, Rabbi Akiva Eiger writes most of his literature. So much of the stuff, which is very vast, overwhelming amounts of responsa, overwhelming amounts of commentaries, and he also has chidushim on Gemara, tons and tons of literature. To the extent they say, legend has it that he had a scribe that would write down his stuff because he was busy. So he had someone else that would transcribe it, and the guy couldn't keep up with all the stuff. Like he had too much stuff that like, not even all of it was published. But what happens basically is that in his 30s, so now we're talking about 1790s. In the 1790s, Rabbi Akiva Eiger had become one of the most prominent rabbis. He was in Lissa, which was a small town, but then he came to Friedland, which was a bigger town, and he's now getting paid as a Rav. And we have many tshuvas of that time. We just said that he wrote a lot of his literature during that time. So his name is getting out there. And more and more people are starting to write kashas to him, shilas to him, and he's answering them. So we have all of this on record. Ultimately, he becomes one of the biggest names in Poland, Western Prussia at that time, but one of the biggest names in Poland, to such an extent that there's a very somewhat humorous, obviously not so humorous because of the matter, but there's someone, a wealthy man who passed away, and in his tzava, in his will, it says, I want my money, or at least a big portion of my money, to go to the Gadol Hador. That's what he writes. No more detail than that. I want my money to go to the Gadol Hador. So now the Beis Din has to figure out, okay, who's the Gadol Hador? Right? This is a real thing that happens. Who's the Gadol Hador? So they're looking around, and you could look at the Chasam Sofer. Who else lives around this time, the end of the 18th century, that could be the Gadol Hador? The Vilna Gaon is at the end of his life. I'm not sure if this happened before or after. The Vilna Gaon passes away in about 1797 or so. So I'm not sure if this story happens before or after. Who else? Who's the Vilna Gaon's prime student? Rav Chaim Volozhiner, right? Rav Chaim of Volozhin is perhaps the main student, even though they didn't really learn with each other, whatever. They had correspondence, the main student of the Vilna Gaon. So in the end, apparently, the championship game came down to Rav Chaim of Volozhin and Rabbi Akiva Eiger. And in the end of the day, they chose Rabbi Akiva Eiger, and Rabbi Akiva Eiger was not happy. Rabbi Akiva Eiger was known for his humility, which we'll get to in a second. And he said, I don't want the money, but at the same time, the Beis Din made a psak. And how am I supposed to reject this psak of the Beis Din of other gedolim? So he says, fine, I'll take the money, but I'm not going to use it. What's he going to use it for? He uses it to make a hospital. And that's what you see in this random building on your sheet over here. You see there's a white building in the bottom of the top section. That's the hospital that Rabbi Akiva Eiger apparently builds with the money from this psak din. The money that he gets from this wealthy man as being titled the Gadol Hador, he takes the money, he says, I don't want anything to do with it. Let's make a hospital. So much so was his name tied to this hospital that apparently, story has it, that the Enlightenment, right, the Maskilim, the reformers, actually were against the hospital. Like they were actively, trying to bring down the hospital. I'm not really sure how, verbally or with stuff. I don't know what they did. But they were like against this hospital because that was Rabbi Akiva Eiger's hospital. Not because he was in the hospital as a patient, but because he built it. He literally took the money and built the hospital. Then his wife dies. His wife, whose name was Glickel, son of Rav Yitzchak Margolios of Lisa, so she passes away, and this is a really difficult time for Rabbi Akiva Eiger. We have...
At a young age?
She was a young age. He was only about 36. So this is 1790, 1795. Some of these things can happen, few years earlier, a few years after, I'm not really sure. But we have a letter. This is February 9th. I actually wrote it down. February 1796, his wife passed away, and he was really, he was distraught. He didn't have the ability to do his normal Rabbanus activities. He writes in a letter how he can't even function, and he, in the tshuvas that he's forced to write, he writes in the tshuvas, I'm sorry if I make any mistakes. I'm not in the best, the clearest of mind after my wife passes away. After my wife passed away.
Are these tshuvas written in Hebrew or Yiddish?
Yeah, they're in Hebrew. The ones that I've seen. I mean, he might have written things in Yiddish. I've never seen them.
Okay. Everything I've seen is in Hebrew.
Yeah.
Hebrew,
I think. But as you can imagine, many people try to set Rabbi Akiva Eiger up. He's still a young guy, 36 years old, right? Many people try to set him up with their daughters and different people, and he can't do it. For a while, he can't marry anybody else after Glickel passed away. And then his uncle, Rev Wolf Eiger, also passes away. That uncle that we said was his teacher when he was a teenager, so he also passes away. And now he really wants to leave Rabbanus. He just wants to work. He wants people to leave him alone. He wants time to himself. And he wants to go into some, he wants to go from being a clay kodesh to being a lay kodesh. He wants to just be a regular guy. But as you can imagine, no one lets him do that. He ultimately does remarry, and he has another couple children. He has another few children, one girl and two sons. He has a son named Moshe, who's named after his father. And he has a son who he names after his uncle, Wolf, and he, Binyamin, and he also has a daughter that he names after his mother, Gittel, who also had passed away around this time. So he had a difficult sort of stretch there. Well, no, his mother passes away a little bit later, but that's when he ultimately has a daughter named after her, Gittel. But this is, he's remaking his life. He's still in Friedland until the year, until he's about, let's see, I'm not going to say it all the way, but he ultimately moves to a place called Posen, but we're going to take a break and get back to the Chasam Sofer. So that's about the year 1811. He has that daughter, and he names her Gittel after his mother. So that's when he's the age of 50, 1811. Back to the Chasam Sofer, back to Germany. So Chasam Sofer at the same time was also coming out of yeshiva, and the Chasam Sofer follows his Rebbe, Rev Nassan Adler, to a place called Moravia, to a smaller city next to where Rev Nassan Adler becomes the Rav. And when he's 24 years old, so a little later than Rabbi Akiva got married, at the age of 24, about 1786, so he marries the daughter of the daughter of the rabbi in Moravia, which is next to where Rav Nassan Adler was, marries. Her name was Sarah Jervitz, and the family apparently didn't like the shidduch, and the Chasam Sofer asked Rav Nassan Adler, and Rav Nassan Adler wouldn't tell him whether or not it was a good idea. They end up getting married, and they never have children. And for whatever reason, I'm not really sure why I have this in my notes, but he became he became very active in the Chevra Kadisha until he becomes, the age of 32, he becomes the Rav of Drezhnitz. And then a few years later, he becomes the rabbi of a bigger city called Mattersdorf, which you've probably heard of. Mattersdorf, Drezhnitz was a smaller city, Mattersdorf. So in his later 30s, he and Rabbi Akiva Eiger were both rabbis of big cities, right? That's their big, they got on the big stage at the end of their 30s. And over there, he makes a yeshiva, and he attracts many hundreds of talmidim. And when he's 39, about 1800, the chief rabbi of Pressburg, which is now the capital of Slovakia, I don't think it's called Pressburg anymore.
Bratislava.
So the chief rabbi passes away, and for 5 years they looked for a replacement. And they finally were able to convince the Chasam Sofer when he was 44 years old that he should take over in 1806. He becomes the Rav, and it was not an easy time in Pressburg. He had opened a yeshiva, which is what he's known for. The yeshiva of Pressburg was this big place, and he had hundreds of talmidim. But there again, also, in Pressburg, many fires destroyed Jewish homes. It was difficult times. And in 1809, the Napoleon's army comes through the city and also does more destruction. So the city's not doing too well in general. And then also, a couple years later, there are more fires. And the age of 50, so he's now 50, we've caught up with Rabbi Akiva Eiger. At the age of 50 in 1812, his wife Sarah, who he's never had children with, she also passes away. So the question now becomes, in the year 1812, what should we do? What should happen? Well, it just so happens, Rabbi Akiva Eger's daughter, also named Sarah, goes by Searle, also her husband passes away. Rabbi Akiva Eger is 51 years old. Her husband passes away, and she's left a widow. Rabbi Akiva Eger doesn't know what to do. So he picks up the phone. Probably not. But he picks up the quill, and he writes a letter to the Chassam Sofer. And he says, I've got a daughter. She's obviously tzadekes, and she's an Eshes Chayil. Do you know anybody who's good for my daughter? Chassam Sofer, being a prominent rabbi, says, I don't have time for this. I'll give it to my gabbai. So he gives it to his gabbai, and the gabbai is thinking to himself, wait a second, Rebbe, your wife just passed away. Would you be willing to take on the shidduch? Would you be willing to marry Rebbe Akiva Eger's daughter? Now remember, Rebbe Akiva Eger and Chassam Sofer were born 11 months apart from each other. So this is a big generational divide for him to marry a younger daughter. But at the same time, you have to remember that his first wife didn't have any children. So in some ways, he's probably looking for a younger wife so that he can have children. Chassam Sofer writes Rebbe Akiva Eger a letter. And he says, you know, the halacha says that you're supposed to marry your daughter off to a Talmud Chacham. As long as you're willing to forego that condition, I'll marry your daughter. That's what he says. Rebbe Akiva Eger writes back to the Chassam Sofer. He says, the Gemara also tells us that you should only marry a daughter of a Talmud Chacham. So if you're willing to forego that condition, so then you can marry my daughter. So they trade these humble jabs, and they ultimately get married. Rabbi Akiva Eger, the contemporary of the Chassam Sofer, becomes the father-in-law of the Chassam Sofer in the year 1812. A crazy, really fascinating story, to such an extent that the children of the Chassam Sofer, the children that we now know of as the children of the Chassam Sofer, when I was at YU, I'm pretty sure, I don't want to say their names or anything, I was an RA, so there were freshmen on my floor who were triplets, Schreibers, and they were descendants of the Chassam Sofer. So all descendants of the Chassam Sofer, because of his first wife, all the descendants are also descendants of Rebbe Akiva Eger. Any Schreibers that come from the Chassam Sofer are also Enoch Lach of Rebbe Akiva Eger. The Ksav Sofer, the Chassan Sofer, you might know those names, those are all descendants of not only the Chassam Sofer, but also Rebbe Akiva Eger. Coming from this, from Rebbe Akiva Eger's daughter, Sarala. So that's the story of how they sort of, their worlds collide. And it's not only that they have one, two children, they have 10 children together. Sarala has 10 children, and 3 boys, 7 girls, and they live in Pressburg together, and his fame just grows as the big rav of the Pressburg yeshiva. He has almost 1,500 tshuvas, and obviously he writes a lot of them in Pressburg with his talmidim. He also didn't want to publish them because he thought other people could write better tshuvas, etc. But he and Rebbe Akiva Eger are very similar in that respect, that they're both big gedolim of the generation, part of the golden age of the 19th century in Hungary and Poland for rabbinic Jewry, and they both have this certain humility about them, that neither of them wanted to take any money to be rabbis, neither of them wanted to publish their tshuvas. Reb Chaim of Volozhin apparently once said that Rebbe Akiva Eger, if he had the time, he could write the same stuff as Rebbe Akiva Eger. The same tshuva, the same chidushim. There's one thing he couldn't do, and that is write what Rebbe Akiva Eger writes in many of his tshuvas in the beginning, which is, yesterday I got your letter, and this is my answer. says Reb Chaim of Volozhin, I could give the answer, but not write that quick. I couldn't think of it that quickly. Rebbe Akiva Eger had this recall that he was able to do it. Once a man needed some rabbinic expertise in one of his court cases in the Beis Din, and he writes to Rebbe Akiva Eger if he can come and help him, and Rebbe Akiva Eger writes back to him with all these very flowery descriptions of this guy. But this guy was not a rabbi. He wasn't some genius. But Rebbe Akiva Eger writes, Hagon, Hachasid, he gives all these flowery descriptions of him, and this guy couldn't even read Hebrew. He wasn't very well educated. So he gives it to some other Rav or some other guy in the community who could read. And the guy says to the man, I think Rebbe Akiva Eger is making fun of you, because he's calling you all these very irrelevant names as if to say, like, you're none of these things. Like, why are you wasting my time? So the guy goes back to Rebbe Akiva Eger and he says, I'm so sorry that, like, maybe I offended, you know, the Rav. And Rebbe Akiva Eger says, no, I mean, that's what they write to me when they ask me questions, so I figured that I could write it to you also, because I'm not that great either. So that's why he writes it to the other person. So that's what Rabbi Akiva Eiger says.
Unless you made a habit of doing that.
It was a formality for some, but that's what the legend goes, that when they asked Rabbi Akiva Eiger why he did that, that's what he responded. So but there was a formality to say.
Did he write that to everybody?
Right, right. You have to look at all the tshuvas. But around this time, we said that the Chassam Sofer is really taking off in Pressburg, and he's this huge yeshiva. And around the same time, Rabbi Akiva Eiger is also recruited by a bigger city, a bigger place called Posen. People might be familiar with Posen. And Posen was a much bigger city to the extent that apparently, when Rabbi Akiva Eiger was younger, he used to write Shilas to the Rav of Posen, I forgot who it was, and the Rav of Posen used to be very delayed in getting back to him. Speaking of, you know, turnaround for Tshuvas, and the Rav of Posen said to Rabbi Akiva Eiger, when you become the Rav of Posen, you'll see why it takes me so long. So here's the Rabbi Akiva Eiger, apparently. This is on the Hebrew Wikipedia page for Rabbi Akiva Eiger. It gives us the daily schedule of Rabbi Akiva Eiger. What did Rabbi Akiva Eiger do every day? So here's the beginning. It starts at 4 o'clock, and I do not mean p.m., It starts at 4 o'clock. At 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock, he learned Mishnayos. At 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock, he gave shir to the working people of the city, the Baal Batim. And at 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock, he davened Shacharis. I guess he would have a minion. And at 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, it gave a whole hour, he ate breakfast. Entire hour for breakfast, but the kicker comes later because he doesn't eat lunch. But he gives an entire hour for breakfast, 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock. I don't know, like, who's giving over these reports, but apparently he had coffee with no sugar. That's what it said. 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock, get this one. Dave is going to like this one. From 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock, the beginning of morning Seder, he learned Tanakh.
Ooh.
He didn't learn Gemara, he learned Tanakh. He learned Tanakh from 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock, and then from 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock, he gave a shir in Gemara. And then at 11 o'clock, he would give a chazar shir. He wouldn't have lunch, he would just drink some soup while he learned. That was his lunch. I don't know who made it for him, whatever. And this is perhaps the most interesting. When you thought Tanakh was interesting, you thought 4 o'clock was interesting. This is, to me, the most interesting piece of Rabbi Akiva Eiger's daily schedule. From 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock every day, he would take a nap.
Get up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
I guess so. He slept. He took a nap in the middle of the day, which is even more interesting because there's a Gemara that talks about not sleeping in the middle of the day, but I'm sure Rabbi Akiva Eiger took care of that Gemara.
Don't they say that's not?
I guess so.
Yeah.
Wait... Esther's going to like the next thing, or the two things from now, which is also apparently helpful. From 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock, he sat on the basin, which is probably not so healthy. But after 4 o'clock, they say, legend has it, that after he finished in the basin, he would have a glass of wine. He would have a glass of wine 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So that's why he did it. He dafka did it after he finished giving psak. He finished his dionys, and then he would have a glass of wine.
That's supposed to be healthy.
It's apparently supposed to be healthy. That's what the latest studies say, that it's healthy, until a few years from now when we figure out it's like the worst thing, you know, that you could have besides cyanide. I don't know. Every year it's something else. But yeah, ad kan right now in our history, it's healthy for you. Not too much, obviously. But then he has, after he has his wine, he actually had a set time to go visit people in the hospitals. Bikur Cholim and Nichav Avelim. When he got older, he got too busy, he actually hired someone to do it on his behalf. I don't know if you get the mitzvah the same way, but it's interesting, Shaila. In some ways, yeah. He hired an assistant rabbi. Mirza Hashem. Okay. Then he davens Mincha. After Mincha, he gave a shir specifically on the Magen Avraham. This must have been taken out of like a snapshot of his life, because after a while, you're going to finish the Magen Avraham. You can't do that for 25 years, which is how long he was in Posen, basically. And then he would give that shir Magen Avraham until Maariv. And then after Maariv at 8 o'clock, he would respond to all of his shilas. 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock, he would respond to shilas. 2 hours worth, he would just respond to shilas. And then from 10 o'clock until Chatzos, he would learn his own stuff. That's when he would do his own learning. From 10 o'clock to midnight, halachic midnight, that's when he would do his own learning. I heard once about Rav Shlomo
Av... Midnight to 4.
Apparently midnight to 4. And then an hour in the middle of the day.
Dinner somewhere in there?
No, there was no dinner. Apparently not. There's no dinner. Maybe he had another bowl of soup at night during his shuvas. I don't know.
Glass of wine, actually.
Yeah, maybe the glass of wine was the dinner. I don't know.
He said Maariv.
Yeah, he did Maariv at 8 o'clock. So he had a big breakfast.
Well, he had a big breakfast.
He had a big breakfast. I heard once about Rav Shlomo Aviner, who is a Rav in the old city of Yerushalayim, and apparently they say that the only personal learning that he gets to, he said this, the only personal learning he ever gets to do is Shtaymik Rav Yechad Targum. He gets to learn the Parsha. But other than that, he has no time for his own learning. So Rabbi Kivi Eger did this whole thing up until 10 o'clock. He was teaching everybody else, and then he got to learn himself.
Obviously, he's doing only Kedusha things.
Yeah.
Where do the children and the wife come in?
Yeah, well, right now, at this, so again, this might come back into at what point in time the snapshot is from. But at this point, this is later on in Posen. His children are probably at least teenagers at this point. He's in his 60s. That's what I would assume. It's the snapshot from then.
Shabbos.
About posing. Yeah. We saw. Was the last Legends lesson the Arizal?
No.
It wasn't? What was the last one? Oh, no, sorry. It was our cook. But two times ago when we talked about the Arizal, so we said the Arizal used to go onto an island for all 6 days of the week, and he would only come back on Shabbos. He would only speak Torah, and he'd only speak in Hebrew. So that's really Akasha, what he did with his children. But at least Rabbi Kivi Eger was home. He did have breakfast in the morning. Maybe he had a family breakfast. I don't know. He had a nap. Maybe he saw them when he was taking a nap. I don't know. But apparently when he was 71 years old, the Chassam Sofer's wife, his daughter Sarala, passes away. That's 71. So he's, that's 1832. And Sarla passed away, but the Chassam Sofer doesn't want to tell Rabbi Kivi Eger because he was already frail at that time. And he wasn't doing well enough to accept that news. And then when at the age of 76, Rabbi Kivi Eger gets sick.
Well, that's a little odd because he'd be in Avil and he's not for his...
Yeah, partner. It's interesting. No, you don't become an Avil until you actually hear the news. And if you hear it later, so then you don't have the same kind of availus. You'd have like shloshim or something, but you wouldn't have... I don't think you would keep a shiva if you hear it too late.
I think you only keep
maybe
the day
that day.
Here.
Yeah, something like that. So Rabbi Kivi Eger, when he was 76, in the year 1837, he gets very sick during the month of Elul. And the day after Yom Kippur, he contracts pneumonia. And a few days later, on the 13th of Elul, on the 13th of Tishrei, he passed away. And the city of Posen, Jews and non-Jews, all came to mourn him. And out of humility, he requested that they didn't give him a eulogy, but that they learn for him, Le'ilo Nishmaso. Obviously, it's not only for him that they have eulogies. I'm not sure exactly what they did, though. Obviously, we said he wrote extensively. What's interesting about Rabbi Kivi Eger is, and this is similar to the Chassam Sofer, which we'll see in a second, what's interesting about him was that he was Eish Lahava against reformers. Right, he was very staunchly opposed, as you can imagine, to the Enlightenment and to the dilution of Rabbinic Judaism and Orthodoxy, as we call it nowadays. At the same time, however, he was willing to, I would say, acculturate some of Judaism. And he had many students, apparently, who gave their own sermons, who gave their drashas in German, which was a step, you know, that is a step inside of secularization, but he was willing to do that. He was also, I think...
Was he contemporary with Hirsch towards the end?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, he was, for sure. Not just to the end, I think, yeah. He actually allowed inside of the yeshiva some secular studies in terms of training for trades, trade skills and stuff like that. He allowed that to happen for the yeshiva guys. He wouldn't say, no, you can't do anything. He would say like 1 or 2 hours or so. He allowed them to have some trade skills developed instead of learning, which is, you know, obviously also something which was not necessarily the norm in the previous years, previous generations. Okay. Happens to be that the Volozhiner Yeshiva was also going through much of the same difficulties, but later in the century, later in the 19th century, not at this point. This is in the 1830s, 1820s.
The Torim there, Eretz, was his or her?
He was tolerant of it. I don't think he was like the flagship, like, let's do it, but Rav Hirsch was more of that, you know, he pushed for that vision.
Where is his
camper? I think it's in Posen. I don't think he ever left Posen. You have his Matseva here, I'm not really sure. You can see the different places that he was. Underneath his name says Harav Rabbeinu Akiva Eger Avar. I don't know what that says. La'avrei Vav. What's that say? Either way, you see it underneath. It says Bekilas Kadosh. I think that means Masya Friedland.
Yeah.
That's where he was for 10 to 15 years. And then after that, it says Pozna, which is Posen. He was a Rav in Lisa also, but that was like a smaller town. It wasn't really, it wasn't his reputation. Yeah, I guess not, yeah.
What was the name of his yeshiva?
I don't know what his name of his yeshiva was. It doesn't say on the Matseva. I'm sure we could look it up. I don't know if they had names. It's just Rabbi Kivager's yeshiva.
What are these hats that they're wearing?
What are the hats?
I mean,
apparently, these are both, which is rare, these are both confirmed pictures of Rabbi Kiva Eger from reputable sources. This wasn't just like the butcher of Rabbi
Kiva. Are they just general that Gentiles wore?
I would assume so. I would assume
Black hats don't even look at them.
Yeah, and well, back then, that's what they used to wear. Yeah.
This hat here is the same.
Similar one, yeah. So over to the Chassam Sofer. So Chassam Sofer, as we said, married Rabbi Kiva Eger's daughter. Oh, we haven't finished with Rabbi Kiva Eger. Rabbi Kiva Eger, besides being an opponent of the Reformers, he was also allegedly an opponent to Hasidus. Now this is much controversy. Hasidus really takes off in the end of the 18th century. That's when the Vilna Gaon is going at it in terms of his tzavas and stuff like that. But there was a letter that was apparently written by Rabbi Kiva Eger while he was a rabbi in Lisa. And it says that he doesn't like Hasidus. There are problems with this letter. First of all, the fact that someone would ask Rabbi Kiva Eger when he's a 22-year-old little, you know, nobody in terms of the people in general culture, that why would they ask his opinion about Hasidus? Doesn't make any sense. But secondly, early on, if he's in his younger 20s, that's only 1780. It's not really a controversy as much than it is like later on with the Baal HaTanya and things like that. But and I mean, not so much farther after that, but it doesn't make sense. And people, I think, have proven that that letter was a forgery. Although there are other legends that also follow Rabbi Kiva Eger. So, for instance, he has a son. His son's name was Shlomo. And Rabbi Shlomo LaEger tried to go learn by the Katzke Rebbe. There's one version of the story that says Rabbi Kiva Eger got on his own two feet, went to the Katzke Rebbe's Beis Medrash, and pulled his son out of the Beis Medrash and went back to Posen. That's one story. And the other story, however, is that Rabbi Shlomo's son, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Eger, who was a Talmud, I don't know if we've quoted him yet in our Thursday night class, who was a Talmud of the Katzker and then of Rav Mordechai Yosef Leiner, the Ishbitzer. He apparently was a close Talmud of him, and he was very close with Rav Tzadok of Lublin. They were sort of like a tag team, who I quoted on Rosh Hashanah. And apparently, Rabbi Kiva Eger was much more tolerant of his grandson being a chassid than his son being a chassid. And he used to learn with him and things like that. There are a lot of controversy over these legends.
This wasn't all that relevant in the areas where he lived.
It was starting to become. Not necessarily in the end of the 18th century, but especially later on.
In places in what are now Western Poland and
right.
Well, Western Germany, and Hasidus was, I think, much more bigger.
Right, so
further east. I mean,
So it could be a matter of time. Like when his grandson, Reb Leib LaEger, is part of this trend of the Ishbitzer, so he follows Rav Tzadok to Lublin, which is not so far away. Lublin is also, isn't that also on the western end of Poland? Maybe not on the coast, but it's not on the eastern side. I think it's towards the western side. So it's not so far away. But either way, Hasidus starts to creep into the bigger cities when you get into the 19th century, like Gore and Lublin and Krakow. So it's true, at the beginning, it was like, it was off to these little shtetls.
Those
everywhere.
Polish-speaking areas, I think those were more Polish
areas,
I don't know.
Right, well, the Polish Hasidus takes off with Simcha Banim and Pshischa and everything like that. But yeah, it would take a little bit of time to develop that. So that could address why there's a differentiation between his son and his grandson, because it hadn't yet become popular or mainstreamed, I should say. So that's another thing about Rabbi Akiva Eiger, that he ultimately seems to have been tolerant of Hasidus when he realizes that it wasn't as bad as people made it out to be originally. But up to a lot of debate, a lot of interesting articles online you can find if you dig deep enough to understand Rabbi Akiva Eiger's stance on that. Either way, the Chasam Sofer, we said he married Saralah, had 10 kids. This is already in 1820s. He was even more opposed to, very actively opposed to much of the reforms going on in the Enlightenment and surrounding areas. He would write many tshuvas in regards to distancing ourselves around. I remember one tshuva specifically that I once learned about the problem of having an organ in shul, even if it's not Shabbos, because of how it resembles what they did. They would do it on Shabbos. He was saying, not even ever. Like, it's a very long tshuva, but I remember the tshuva that he was very, very against it. He also never allowed secular studies in yeshiva like Rabbi Akiva Eiger. So that's one point of distinction between the two. He did, however, have many talmidim that ended up making Aliyat Eretz Yisrael with his support, which is something which maybe others didn't. You know, I don't know anything about Rabbi Akiva Eiger's support of Eretz Yisrael, but he definitely had talmidim that went there. Not only that, but he actually was going to write his own sefer on astrology until he found out that his Rebbe, the Hafla, Rav Pinchas Levi Horowitz, already wrote one. I think it was like Sefer HaBris or something like that. Sefer HaBris. Interestingly enough, he had written it anonymously, so the Chasam Sofer didn't even know it was his Rebbe. He later found out, but either he had the Sefer, he was going to write his own book on astrology until he saw the Sefer. He said, oh, I don't need to, someone already wrote it. Like his tshuvas, he said, I don't need to publish my tshuvas, somebody already is writing tshuvas. But ultimately, Baruch Hashem, we got his tshuvas.
Astrology or astronomy?
Probably astronomy, but maybe both. The things that are halachic, which I guess is more astronomy. He was famous for a certain line, which is taken out of context but applied to many things, which is Chadash is Asur Min HaTorah, which was a reference, or at least people think was a reference to the reform movement and things like that, and they apply it to all different types of things. But at the same time, he was a little bit more, willing to tolerate certain things, much like Rabbi Akiva Eiger was, not necessarily secular studies in the yeshiva itself, but he was apparently okay with people being clean-shaven, which was obviously much more of a modern look. He was okay with doing mitzitza with a sponge, as opposed to with your mouth, which was also something which you can imagine was, if it was controversial today, it was controversial back then. He also gave a haskama to a Talmud who published a parish of Rashi translated into German, which you can imagine was also something which was a barrier you don't want to cross. Rav Hirsch did it, obviously, himself, but... Well, I guess in terms of that, one place that he did draw the line, that in his ethical will, which was read at his Levaya, when he died on the 25th of Tishrei in 1839, he writes in his ethical will, don't read Mendelssohn. That's what he writes. Which is also of controversy. Was Mendelssohn himself, ill-motivated, or was it just his followers that took it in the wrong direction? It's all controversy. But even though he allowed his Talmud to write a parish of Rashi in German, he didn't let people read Mendelssohn, which is interesting.
What about the Gemara itself? What about an art scroll type of thing?
I don't know if they had one. That's interesting. Hirsch, it's a big undertaking.
Hirsch
wrote it in German. He wasn't apologetic about it.
Yeah, that's what I said before.
He wrote in German.
Yeah.
And he detested Mendelssohn.
Right, refers, you mean. Yeah, it refers to Tessa Mendelssohn for sure also, but...
Didn't Mendelssohn's offspring become Christian?
Yeah, his grandson was like a famous violinist or something.
Composer
or something, yeah. Either way, so yeah, there are gradations of where to draw the lines and how to make the balance. So, almost exclusively, everyone was against Mendelssohn, but also, both Rabbi Akiva Eiger and Chasam Sofer were tolerant of their students using German to give over Torah. Rav Hirsch was obviously a step even further to he himself giving drushes in German and promoting the gymnasium and the double curriculum and things like that. He actually differed from his father-in-law in his approach to the Gemara, his father-in-law being Rabbi Akiva Eiger. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger Rabbi Akiva Eiger, while he Rabbi Akiva Eiger was much more of a pilpul type, this kind of gets into the weeds. We don't have to understand it. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger would be more incisive in with his analysis. The Chasam Sofer was more of a pashtan. He would look at the Gemara as it's supposed to be and just get the Pesach Halacha from it, not going into all the details and analysis and things like that, like was popular specifically in Volozhin and other places. He's buried in Pressburg. If you look at the page for a second, you'll notice that you have a picture of the Chasam Sofer, then you have this little monument on the side. Has anyone ever been to this or knows what this is? This is actually an above-ground stairwell to get to his grave. The Chasam Sofer and his entire family were preserved from the Pressburg Cemetery. Everything else was destroyed through different, strings being pulled. For the sake of the Chasam Sofer's family, you'll see in the bottom left picture, that's all of his family and his gravesite. They preserved it underground. Somehow they were able to do it. Unclear how. It could have been money. It could have been some foreign pressure. And that's his actual tombstone on the right bottom. And so that's they make this whole big monstrosity above ground so that you can go underground to see his matzevas. But that just shows you the reverence not only of the Jewish people but also of the general community that they had for the Chasam Sofer. And nearby there's a bus station which is named the Chasam Sofer bus station. I don't know how to say it in Hungary or whatever language they say over there, whatever language they use there. But there was a bus station named after Chasam Sofer.
Will people visit
today? I've heard people have told me that they went. Someone here told me that they went to Chasam Sofer's Matzeva underground. I forgot who it was. Someone told me after a shir once.
Is there a halacha problem with that? Or?
I don't think so. Not that I know of.
General.
There might be in terms of where the tumma goes above ground. That might be an interesting question, but I'm not sure. It depends how what.
Your coin.
It's a problem for your coin. Yeah, but one interesting thing about the Rabbi Akiva Eiger. So Chasam Sofer and Rabbi Akiva Eiger both write many chedushim on Shas. They both write tshuvas. Chasam Sofer has something Rabbi Akiva Eiger doesn't really, if I'm not mistaken, which is drashos on Torah. And we have some over here. The Chasam Sofer's drashos are very vast. He has multiple volumes, and they've been recorded from, it seems like, his students. You can see the dates, and they're some of them are compiled together. He has on holidays, which we'll read from in a second. Rabbi Akiva Eiger, I don't think, has a lot of drashas. He might have, but they're very limited. They're not very well known. Rabbi Akiva Eiger, however, has something which the Chasam Sofer is not well known for, which is his kashas on the Gemara. Rabbi Akiva Eiger, in his Gilyonos, the Gilyone HaShas, is famous for asking kashas. And the benchmark of a yeshiva student is whether or not you try to tackle Rabbi Akiva Eiger's kashas. And I heard someone giving over a shiur about Rabbi Akiva Eiger's kashas today. And the same conversation he said, and it's true, it's humorous. Same conversations always happen when you try to tackle Rabbi Akiva Eiger's kashas. Every time you try to answer it, the question is why didn't Rabbi Akiva Eiger answer that? Because whatever you thought of, Rabbi Akiva Eiger thought of too. So then the shiur doesn't become answering his questions, it becomes questioning your answers of his questions in order to figure out why he didn't answer that. So it's a whole thing, but he has this sort of incisive analysis of all the Gemaras, and oftentimes you can see the humility like pouring out of his words. I remember I once said over in the shiur over here Shabbos afternoon, but he'll always finish his statement off. If he has like a kasha, it'll be Tzarech Iyun. I have to look into it more. Tzarech Iyun Gadol. Or Hashem, may your Einai, Hashem's going to show me what the answer is. The most impactful one that I've ever seen is when he's asking a kasha on Tosfos and Gemara and Pesachim about putting someone getting the Karan Pesach from inside the Beis HaMikdash, but they couldn't actually go into the Beis HaMikdash, and Tosfos has this whole construct of how they could do it. Sitting at the entrance, Rabbi Akiva Eiger has a kasha on it based on another Gemara, if I remember, and then he says the following words: "Velo zachisi lamod al omek divreim hakdoshim." I have not yet merited to figure out their holy understanding of the sugya. Meaning, it wasn't. This is a problem. It's not. You guys are wrong. It's I have not yet come to the understanding to figure out what they mean. It's a clear kasha, and it's a clear thing that you have to work out, but his understanding was that there must be something that I'm not aware of either.
Does he always understand that there is an answer? There's no teku type of thing?
Even a teku, there are answers. We just don't know what it is. Right? That's a different way of looking at it, but yeah. So lastly, I wanted to just give over a piece from the Chasam Sofer's drashas on Yom Noraim. We say in, I think it's in El Dabar Hashem, we say, Lachzos B'Noam Hashem, right? David HaMelech says, Achas She'alti Me'es Hashem Asa, Shifti B'Es Hashem Kol Mechai, Lachzos B'Noam Hashem. What does it mean, Lachazot B'Noam Hashem? Lachzot means, like Chose Yeshayahu, Chazon Yeshayahu means, to see. Lachzot B'Noam Hashem. With the pleasantness of Hashem. What does that mean? To see the pleasantness of Hashem. What are you looking at? So says the Chasam Sofer the following. That there should be pleasantness to Hashem. That's one way to understand it. That when we bring kavod to Hashem, Hashem's going to be happy. When someone sees on the holy days of Yom Noraim, Ech miskabsin mikol Yisrael mispaolin mikiros libam, that everybody comes to shul and they're all davening together. Afalpi, and this is I spoke about on our Shabbos Shiva Drasha. Afalpi shelakol echad kavana acharas. Even though everybody has their own reason for coming to shul. Everyone has their own intention for davening mikiros libam from their heart. They're all davening. They're all coming together. He sees what's obviously making Hashem happy. That everyone's coming together, gathering together to daven. And everyone's coming to confess and to do vidoy on their sins. Im kein, yismachu b'simchas Hashem. Yismach Yisrael b'osav b'simchas osav. That's what it means. Lachzos b'noam Hashem. When David HaMelech says it, I want to see the pleasantness of Hashem. When I go and shifti b'beis Hashem kol yimei, when I want to sit in the Beis HaMikdash, what does that mean? To see the pleasantness of Hashem. The pleasantness of Hashem is brought about through us. When we can all get together and we can all daven on Yom Noraim, we can all come together and have a sincere davening from Kiryas Levon, whatever our intentions are. The fact that we're all striving to be closer to Hashem, the fact that we're all coming together as a community to daven together, that's what's going to be what's the Lachzos B'Noam Hashem, what's going to be the vision of the pleasantness of Hashem, because when something like that happens, it says this Chasam Sofer, Imkein yismachu b'simchas Hashem. That's a time where you obviously bring a certain simcha to Hashem that His people can come together to do the right thing, to make sure that they're doing better than they were before. And that's what the Chasam Sofer leaves us with for the Yom Noraim. The importance of coming together, not just because we have obligations that we have to go through, but also because it brings a certain simcha to Hashem when we're able to do that. So that's the fascinating story, the fascinating lives of Rabbi Akiva Eger and Rabbi Chasam Sofer, very similar in their outlook, very similar in their contributions, vastness, the topics, the activism, some little nuances here and there, but obviously they come even closer together when they marry into each other. And Rabbi Akiva Eger's daughter marries a Chasam Sofer, and all of the grandchildren that come from the Sofers are also his. So they're not only tied together thematically in terms of what they accomplished in their lives, but they're also connected familiarly in terms of their descendants and in terms of their contributions. Everyone should have a Gemar Chasima Tova, and thanks for coming. We will continue in a couple weeks with Mishle, maybe in a few weeks. Maybe we have 2 weeks off, then we'll continue with Mishle, and the week after that, another Legends and Lessons for the next month. Okay. Rabbi Akiva.